Hope the report back will be also very, very, you know, lovely. But may I suggest all the chair try to highlight the point and not necessarily to give the reasons, because everybody knows some of the reasons, and also, frankly speaking, the reasons are debatable. So highlight the points, and if it is possible, give more minutes to others to raise more questions or give their opinions. Can I suggest we start with the discussion on measurement? I got two different orders. So, Andrew, can you start?
Many thanks. We had a lively discussion that pretty well filled the time. We started by working through the example set out in the paper, where we were asked to consider whether the factors guided us towards particular measurement bases. The first one was inventory, where there was a clear majority of the group supporting historical cost, and that was based on the view that the margin that you make on sale arises at the time that you sell the goods and not before. There was, however, a minority that supported some kind of fair value. Perhaps even better would be replacement cost. And they favoured that to show the current margins. And we noted that if that were done, it would be of the first importance to report separately the cost of consumption and the holding gains. And we also noticed that we might be more inclined towards some kind of fair value measurement if there was a good market with readily available prices. On the buildings, again, we thought that fair value might be relevant if the building was readily marketable, but if not, then cost or perhaps value in use might be a more relevant basis. Similarly, on investment properties, we noted that not all markets have got decent fair values available for investment properties, but if there are, there would be a strong case for fair values. Particularly, we noted that that would affect the transactions that the company could enter into currently, such as taking out new loans, which would be based on today's value, not on historical cost. And rentals would presumably be more influenced by current market factors than by historical cost. On that, we noted that we're not quite sure why IAS 40 excludes from its scopes properties for own use, because there are companies such as, for example, insurance companies that find it very strange to have to account differently from their head office, which they could sell just about as readily as any of their other property assets from fair value. The next example was an unlisted equity investment, and we were, I think there was a good degree of nervousness in the group about fair value. The word hot air was used. I think a more technical description is level three. But then we noted that even if you're going to report it at cost, you still have to think about impairment. And if you're going to think about impairment, then that brings in as much of the considerations as any kind of fair value. But here we found the factor of it, how does this contribute to the business activities and future cash flows, really quite helpful, because it may be sensible to try to draw a distinction between an investment that's held as a strategic investment, in which case cost might be a suitable measure, or if it's being held for investment purposes, in which case, notwithstanding there is no market today, you're presumably going to sell it someday. And it's possible that people who are in that kind of business do have sufficient expertise to come up with some kind of current value measurement. For performance obligations, I think we were broadly in the historic cost camp, but we noted that time value of money may be appropriate, and we think historical cost can accommodate time value. So if somebody pays in advance and gets a discount, then that would be included in historical cost. But if there is a performance obligation that you can lay off, for example, some types of warranty obligations, then there might be a case for using fair value. If we did that, then we're not entirely clear when you get the margin and why, and that requires further work. We ended on the easy one, which is the decommissioning liability, and we found it quite difficult to see any alternative to fulfilment value. We weren't sure how you could come up with a historical cost, unlikely to be too many indicators of fair value. But then we got into whether that should be risk adjusted, and I think probably the prevailing view was that probably it should be. We then circled back and said, but obviously, if you are going to lay off your decommissioning liability, then fair value would be the appropriate basis. So really it depends as to what you're going to do with it. We noted that in the course of that discussion, we'd used most of the factors that are identified in the paper as being those identified by the conceptual framework, and so they all seem to be useful. With one minor qualification is that those factors didn't necessarily guide members of the group to coming to the same conclusions. So that, I think, is my summary of where we got to. I'll just end with a disclaimer that the views expressed are those of the group and not necessarily my personal views.
Next, Domo. Can I suggest you put mic as close as possible because there are so many non-English speaking participants.
Okay. Good morning, everyone. So I'd like to share the comments raised in our small group discussion, small group meeting discussion. And the first question we are asked is that the proposed guidance on factors to consider when selecting the measurement basis help you to make decisions about how asset liability should be measured. And the answer, simple answer, is generally yes. The participant generally agree that the factors that is described in the exposure draft is helpful for ISB to determine the appropriate measurement basis. But there are several comments raised. One of the comments is the priority of the factors. In particular, in the context of the relevance, there are two factors noted. One is the how asset liability will contribute to future cash flows. The other is the characteristics of the asset liabilities. And if the factor A and factor B give rise to different outcome, which factor should be prioritized, A or B? The participant noted the different views. One, some say, well, A, how asset liability will contribute to future cash flow should be prioritized always over characteristic of asset liabilities. But others said, well, in some situations, characteristics of the asset liability should be prioritized over the how asset liability will contribute to future cash flows. The second point noted was the order of the consideration. There are discussion about relevance, faithful representation, and other enhancing qualitative characteristics of useful financial information. And the participant discussed which of the relevance and faithful representations should be considered first. And we came to a conclusion that the faithful representation should be considered first and then move on to the relevance first, because it is firstly important to identify whether we should look at group of asset liabilities or the individual asset liabilities. And then if we identify which group of asset liabilities or individual, based on the identification, we should identify what is the relevant measurement basis. So there should be some clarification about order of the constellation. Thirdly, the discussion was about whether the explanation of the two factors, i.e. how asset liability will contribute to future cash flows and the characteristics of asset liabilities are sufficient. Some people said, well, the explanation itself is good, but it's not really sufficient. For example, some said notion of business model could be better explained in the context of how asset liabilities will contribute to future cash flows. And others said, well, the variability of the cash flows, etc., should be discussed more extensively in the context of the characteristics of asset liabilities. Third point is fourth point is the concept of capital maintenance. Some of the question about whether the measurement discussion captures the measurement basis that is out there. For example, replacement cost, current cost, etc. And so although participants understand why ISB will not discuss in great detail about the concept of capital maintenance, but there was a question about whether in the context of the measurement discussion, there could be some discussion about the different concept of capital maintenance, so that at least there could be a better explanation about whether and how the measurement basis out there could be appropriate or not. These are better explained. And lastly, there is a discussion about whether the current the proposal is sufficient to explain the situation when the part of the input to the measurement basis is updated, but other inputs are not updated. For example, discount rate. In case of the amortized cost, cash flow is updated, but discount rate is locked in. And decommissioning liability, the same discussion applies. And therefore, we question or prefer that there should be more elaborate discussion about the partially updated measurement basis. I think I answered question one and two, and the simple answer to question two is, could any of the factors be excluded? People said no. There's no factors to be excluded, so it's very simple answer. To question three, do the table summarizing the information provided by each of the measurement bases help you to make decisions about how asset liabilities should be measured? And there's a table about, so to say, catalog of measurement bases in the paper. And people questioned whether discussion of transaction cost is really necessary in the conceptual framework. The reason this include there's not sufficient discussion about different measurement bases. I mean, there should be a more elaborate discussion about measurement basis from the perspective of reporting financial performance and the measurement basis for the purpose of reporting financial position. But the transaction cost discussion really doesn't distinguish these two measurement bases. And therefore, if we say transaction cost should be included in historical cost, people are not sure whether that discussion is a measurement basis for the purpose of reporting financial position or for the purpose of measurement of financial performance. And so perhaps it relates to the question one and two, but there should be more elaborate discussion about, or separate discussion about measurement basis for the purpose of reporting financial position and for the purpose of reporting financial performance. So I think that's it. Thank you.
Thank you, Andrew and Domo. You control the time very well. Same time, Chris. Sir.
Thank you, everybody. So our group perhaps wasn't as helpful to the ISB as it could have been, because when we were considering whether or not the factors that were listed in the conceptual framework were actually helpful in justifying whether we used a particular measurement basis, we effectively came down to it was our gut instincts first, and then we reverse engineered to have a look at the factors. So I'm not sure where that actually leaves us. But having said that, we did think that the factors were more helpful when we were looking at the liabilities than when we were looking at the assets. So that might be a starting point to think about. So from the asset side, what it really seemed to be coming down to in lots of instances was the more measurement uncertainty there was, then the less comfort people had with fair value. So, and it was also a cost-benefit trade-off. So if you could see that the assets were in an active market or were turning over very quickly, then perhaps people were more comfortable with a fair value. Otherwise, they were very happy to go with historical cost. And I think the other thing that came out that isn't in the factors was the notion of accountability or stewardship, and that in some instances it's very useful to be able to know what your historical cost is, so then at least you understand what your profit margins are. And it's, I think Andrew had also mentioned the same issue, is that people wanted to be able to make sure that the selling profit was in the right period, that there was actually a transaction that was happening there. So when we looked at the characteristic of cash flows from the asset perspective, we felt that there needed to be some extra guidance there, that it wasn't just looking at how you measure future cash flows, it was also the characteristics of those future cash flows. So how certain were you around what those cash flows would actually be? The other thing that did come out was that we felt that entry versus exit was a useful notion to be putting into this chapter as well. So we would certainly be encouraging you to go back and have a think about using those criteria. And it was in the context of whether you had a wholesaler or a retailer that it would be helpful in determining what is the right sort of market that you would actually be looking at, and again, what's the right sort of characteristics of those future cash flows. A couple of other interesting observations that came out was that we did think that perhaps more choice between whether you can actually actively choose fair value or historical costs might be beneficial. One of the things that we were thinking about was that in own-use buildings, in some instances, it would actually be good to have that as a fair value, because that could then be reflected through in a better balance of what your actual cost of operations was going to be, but only in particular circumstances. So again, we just felt that having choice was actually good in some instances. We also noted that we didn't think depreciated replacement cost or current replacement cost actually fitted well under the historical cost definition, and we thought that that perhaps needed to be moved into a current value assessment. And I guess lastly, as an observation, where we seem to be coming down is that people were more comfortable with using fair value for financial instruments, but less comfortable with fair values for things that were more what we would think of as tangible assets. And whether or not that's really a function of the fact that we're not very comfortable and we don't have great faith in what the actual valuation number actually is, and perhaps that needs to be a focus going forward to see whether we can actually improve those particular methodologies. So back to you, Wagyu.
So I think we finished the report back first. Next one, Andrea.
Thank you, Wagyu. Our group was charged to have a look at IAS 37, and the question, see here, how the conceptual framework changes the future. We were a little more cautious and said might change the future because there is no direct outflow from the conceptual framework. There are three areas that the paper looks in. That's the identification of a non-financial liability or a provision in the sense of IAS 37. recognition criteria and measurement criteria. We devoted most of our time to the identification, I suppose, and said the key area is probably with recognizing liabilities that are not legal or not yet legal. And it's that vagueness about, am I economically compelled to do something? Do I have a constructive obligation? Does it feel as if I had an obligation that should be recognized, that people felt uncomfortable? And the problem is that the test probably works both ways. So it could be that some liabilities that you feel should be provided for don't meet the test. It could also be the other way around, that some things that you would never think should be recognized might become recognized. And examples cited were dividends not declared but highly likely, or pensions that are there before they vest. So things to think about, I suppose. There was a very interesting comment about the relationship between a liability and the general definition of a claim. So everything that is on the other side as an asset is a claim, and claims are then divided between equity and liabilities. And the question is, does a present obligation meet the criteria or meet the definition of a claim? And that's exactly in the area of constructive obligations where you could ask, is there a claimant? So it's one of these areas where it probably feels right for you as the obligor to say, well, I want to recognize something, but as there is no claimant at this point, the question is, does it then meet the definition of a claim? Very interesting question. The reason that we then, that the other point that we then got into was a unit of account question. And said, depending on how you define the unit of account, the answer of whether or not an obligation exists could lead to quite interesting results and quite different results. So the question of the unit of account should probably be answered first and not at the end of the thought process. I think currently in the ED, you have it rather in the back end than in the front end. There was some discussion about the past event and whether the past event is really needed. I think there were arguments both in favor and against. Probably it's helpful for some, but not for all. So for some liabilities, it's probably enough to say there is a present obligation, but for some other events, it's highly helpful to say it was their past event, for instance, for the dividends declared, because they relate to the future. We spent less time on recognition and measurement. Recognition, I think, there was a feeling that given that the stress is now on identification of the liability, recognition becomes a rather easy exercise. So if you do have a liability, please do recognize it, full stop. And then the question was, what could hold us off from recognizing them? And I mean, the ED says cost-benefit constraints, that was the obvious ones, but I think there was a feeling in the group that says, no, there could be other issues as well. And those cited were relevance and low probability, and faithful representation / measurement uncertainty that may give good reasons for not recognizing something, although something meets the definition of a liability and is identifiable. With regards to measurement, the participants in the group shared the general direction in the paper and said IS37's model with using an expected value thinks about transferring a liability to a subcontractor. And for the majority of IS37's liabilities, that's not the case, how they are being settled. They are usually settled through fulfillment by the obligating by the entity that's being obligated. So it does make sense to reconsider this, and hence the path down fulfillment value was seen as probably the right way. The one question that was asked was about discounting the future cash flows. Obviously, a cash outflow today, it's more severe than a cash flow tomorrow, so time value of money is an issue. But the question is, what is it that you update? Is it just the cash flows that you expect will be flowing out of the entity, or do you also update the discount rate? And the question is why? And in that, there was a link made back to the framework in general. There is not really a good basis for discounting in an amortized cost environment. We do have quite a good framework around discounting and fair value, but we lack guidance, what do we do and why in an amortized cost treatment. That's about it.
Finally, Rebecca.
So I had the pleasure of also discussing the IS 37 proposals, and I must say the group, should we say, thought it was a helpful way to test the proposals, but really emphasized the two ifs, similar to what Andreas had recognized, was really that this is based on if the conceptual framework proposals are finalized as stated, and if a project was needed. What the group did find is that we did have some concerns, predominantly focused on determining a present obligation. What we felt, and many members expressed, that it seemed that the conceptual framework proposals had really focused on assessing, in essence, concerns that had arisen accounting for levies, and that, in essence, the new focus on determining a present obligation and that it's based on a past event, the question then becomes, what is that past event? And are we looking back in the example of it's based on revenues from a prior period? Is that really the past event, or is the event that something happening in this current year? And that is an area where some clarity is needed so that we truly are identifying current period obligations. But more broadly, the thought was in focusing in on trying to address these kind of current concerns. Are we opening up the present obligation to include more broader possibilities of provisioning, which really had been the original focus of IS 37, which was not to, in essence, allow provisions for future costs? So really that comes to determining, in essence, that past event and whether it is really based on you have actually received a benefit in that period. And we got into alternative examples, including when you would have, in essence, required to put a filter on your smokestack, if you remember that example. And is it because you've polluted in the past, then you're obligated to put on the filter, or is it that you're actually going to put, you've contracted to have the filter and it's been installed? So really focusing in on is determining that present obligation and clarifying past event was very much, I guess, focus of several of the examples that we had. From a recognition perspective, and this is where it was interesting because when we went and discussed it the first time around, people were more supportive and felt that actually it was good to take it from a positive perspective in the sense of saying if we've gone through the efforts of identifying liability, then we should be recognizing it. So there were some that thought, well, maybe we don't need that criteria. And then we started to talk about lawsuits. And after a couple of examples, then realized the benefits, in particular some very complex examples of spurious lawsuits through to those that you feel you may actually end up trying to settle, rather be in order to minimize your costs, even though you know you may win it through a long court battle. But in essence, that kind of recognized the benefits of having a low probability as a way to, in essence, be a second check to know if it's something relevant that we would want to, in essence, recognize that liability. We then started, though, to talk about what does low mean? And is that less than more likely than not? And now we got into estimates, is that 30%, 40%? And what does that then, in essence, bring into the discussion? And also from a measurement uncertainty perspective, there were some strong adjectives in there of extremely unlikely that really started to question what will that effect be and will it help us to actually solve or think through some of those more challenging items and is it good to recognize that obligation? So there was kind of some reflection, some saying that actually enables the use of judgment, that would be good. Yet others, some expressed that as a result of that judgment, we actually may think that it might not affect practice. So something to think about when we are using different terms and if that's the right objective that the board was intending. From a measurement perspective, the view was overall that it was helpful. We felt it was more consistent with actually how these types of obligations are settled using, shall we say, in a fulfillment approach. So marked improvement over the prior IS 37 measurement proposals. In particular, not appreciating that we wouldn't require the recognition of a service margin or hypothetical margin. Though there was some thought as to whether it is a fulfillment value versus a fulfillment cost. So some preferences being expressed then for not having to recognize a, shall we say, a risk adjustment or provision a risk premium as proposed within the framework. So in wrapping up, I guess in answering our question two, was did we think it was helpful in heading in the right direction? The thought was a yes, but. And it really came back to thinking about the broader concerns because we didn't really want to open up, in essence, to allow for provisions for future costs. And certain of the examples the group thought of when it came to considering that is how do you maintain your assets? Or if you're in a startup entity, you're beginning to, you know, you're going to incur certain costs and you know you won't avoid them. You need to carry out that business plan. But those really aren't a liability that you should be recognizing today for those future period costs. So as I mentioned, it was kind of in part in this discussion we started to recognize the importance of that further work in determining what an obligation is and identifying it. And this is when people started to reflect on some of our other standards. So there were concerns raised in relation to termination costs in IS 19, but also in the forthcoming revenue standard when it comes to contingent rent. It's been identified there's measurement uncertainty, so the cost and benefit may be not worth to recognize it. So I think the theme here was it was important to consider across the standards because we really would look like some consistency in determining when to recognize some obligations. And I think there were, I guess overall, I think the group was pleased that we were, in essence, testing the conceptual framework proposals by looking at these specific examples, and I guess encourage that as the ISB work continues to move forward and enhance that guidance on present obligation so that we do know we're capturing the right sets of obligations.
Please, everyone understand.
Yep. Thank you very much for the summary. I think we heard some very good themes coming out of the discussions on measurement in terms of things that we need to think about. I would really be interested in any comments that we might have from the floor in terms of discussions about what potentially is missing from the guidance on how to select a measurement basis. I mean, we heard some of the factors discussed by the chairs here, but I'd be really interested to see if there were some themes coming out in terms of what's missing. I think in our group there was some discussion about comparability and whether that had some influence on the selection of a measurement basis. So I was wondering if anybody in the audience had anything that they would like to say in terms of what was missing from those discussions.
I think one thing that's missing is an explicit tie to the objective of financial reporting. In particular, what I think about is we're accounting for not just what the asset or liability is doing at initial acquisition, but if we think about the objective of financial reporting, it's about amount, timing, and uncertainty of future cash flows and returns to capital providers over time. And if perhaps how that asset or liability could be used is able to be changed without having impediments to change, there are reasons to think about potential changes in how you might realize value over time. Value, not cash, Ian. And I think that's a perspective that's worth incorporating. And so if you can change how you're going to use that asset over time, perhaps an unrealized gain or loss becomes more relevant, even if you're starting off to cash collect.
Please.
I think that one piece that might be missing in your documented thought process so far is when I read the agenda paper 13B, paragraph 6A. You said that the information at the measurement basis will produce in both the statement of financial position and the statement of financial performance. I think you should add on taking into consideration the information that is provided in the statement of cash flows together those there. I think that's a piece that is missing.
Any further suggestions for what might be missing in terms of the factors to consider?
This is a personal view and not one of the group. What I miss, and I missed it in the discussion paper as well, is the notion of value. It seems to me that if what we're trying to do is to say something about the value of assets and liabilities, that will help the financial statements fulfill their objectives. And that, to me, is sort of the starting point. Now, obviously, it's not as simple as saying we want to report the value of the assets, because value is a very difficult concept. But at the moment, it's almost entirely missing, except in that factor that rather curiously says that if the value is likely to change a lot, then that might change your measurement basis. But why isn't value at the heart of it?
If I may be allowed to come with even further wishes of what I might want for, I'd like to have a discussion in the document on the relationship between the definitions of asset and liability and the measurement concept of fulfillment value and value in use, as I think that if that link would be clarified or be broken, that would be nice.
If I may comment, make a couple of comments. The first one is to say a wonderful work done, and a small bit of it will make great progress. But one thing that I thought, and forgive me if I didn't read it properly, one thing I thought was that the original IFRS had timeliness in it, and the concept here seems to have missed that. I don't know whether there's a good reason why that was missed of it.
Sorry, I didn't catch the first bit.
Timeliness.
We did actually discuss whether timeliness would have an implication for measurement, but couldn't really come up with any sort of good explanation of why timeliness would make a difference beyond what is already said in the conceptual framework in chapter two of the exposure draft, which is to say information must be provided on a timely basis if it's going to be useful or if it's going to make a difference to the decisions that users make. So we didn't think there was anything much further that we could say in terms of the implications for measurement than what's already in the conceptual framework.
Can I respond to the suggestion to improve the cash flow? I don't think it's so obviously necessary. Because conceptual frameworks start with general objectives and the cash flows and the financial positions and others. The reason why the boards integrate this into measurement is because so many controversial issues recently is related to whether we should use one measurement basis on balance sheet and whether we should reflect in performance in a similar way or different way. So this is why we highlight, we should do so, consider both sides. But if, as you said, you want to add third dimension, I'm not sure how can we, I want to say, indirectly related to cash flow, but if one at the same time said, describe the measurement basis from both balance sheet, income statement, in addition, cash flow statement. I'm not sure how can we describe the principles more clearly. I don't want to debate with you. We have no further time. So how about John?
Okay, well, I would just like to thank you all for your feedback on the possible implications, the paper on the possible implications for IAS 37. The main point that I've taken away from that feedback is a possible concern that we might be broadening the definition of a liability too much in the proposals. And this is something that we will actually test, possibly with some examples where people feel that might meet the definition that they don't think should meet the definition. So anybody who's got any examples like that, I'd be delighted if you would pass them on to me. In the meantime, you might be interested that we've recorded a webinar and put it on the conceptual framework page of the ISB's website. And it's a webinar called A Closer Look at Liabilities and Executory Contracts. And in that webinar, we do go into some of the examples that came up, like the smoke filter example and like the aircraft maintenance example. And I explain in that why I don't think that in these cases there would be a provision to recognise, so there would be no change to current practice. But any other examples that you can send to me, I'd be very grateful to receive. Thank you.
Any other viewpoints? Kimberly.
I guess the reason why we're concerned that, notwithstanding that it may be an executive contract, if you take a maintenance provision and you haven't yet carried out the maintenance work, so you could say I haven't received the benefits of that maintenance activity, which might say, well, okay, that means I haven't got a liability. I think if you look at the guidance, when you take the two together, first of all, the practical ability to avoid, you can tick that off if you have to maintain your aircraft or whatever it is to carry on. But even the second one, even if you say, oh, I haven't received the benefits, you have conducted the activities that determine the extent of the obligation, because you have used the aircraft, which has caused wear and tear, and that determines how much maintenance it needs in order to carry on operating. So the conduct, the activities part of the guidance can be read very broadly. It may not be intended to be read that broadly, and I think it's primarily been put in there for levies, but having put it in there, it then, I think, opens the door that there's all sorts of things that you can link back to activities that have occurred in the past that then determine what you need to do in the future in order to carry on operating your business, and that's the concern. And the other example we talked about was future operating losses in a startup business, where you have to carry on making those losses in order to carry on for your business plan. So you tick the no practical ability to avoid box, and then when you get into conducting the activities, again, you might say, well, I haven't received the benefit or whatever it is, like whether it's future salary, so you could maybe cross it out for benefits. But when you look at the conducting the activities piece of it, you can say, well, I've already established my business, I've put out my business plan to the market, saying this is what I'm going to do, and so you can also get yourself into an argument that I have actually conducted those activities already. So I think it's that piece of it that can be read more broadly than what was intended, and so I think those are a couple of examples to think about.
Thank you, Kimberly. I agree that at these situations that you've identified, you can be in a position where you've got no practical ability to avoid doing something, and there has been a past event. But in these situations, I think, and obviously we can discuss it more, but I think that in these situations there is an obligation, but it's an obligation to exchange resources. Yes, you've got to do something, but you're going to get something back. And in these situations, there is only a liability if what you've got to give out is more than what you'll get back.
Just to say, I was talking about situations where you haven't even yet got the executory contract, so the executory contract doesn't necessarily help you.
Please.
Yeah, I just wanted to share a few observations from the IBSASB's conceptual framework work, and it was very interesting listening to the discussion because so many of the points that have been made actually resonated with our own discussions. I think looking at measurement, we had exactly the same discussion around historic cost, current value, greater emphasis for us on service potential. And certainly the points on entry and exit resonated with where we went in that discussion. We, in our section on measurement, we actually, after some debate, actually ended up with a measurement objective. So we ended up with the objective to select those measurement bases that most fairly reflect the cost of services, operational capacity and financial capacity of the entity in a manner that is useful in holding the entity to account and for decision-making purposes. So we linked it back to the overall objectives in terms of financial reporting. You know, you can argue about the formulation of that objective, and I know Andrew, having been involved in our project, would certainly have views on that, but certainly we ended up with that objective in there. We ducked the issue around transaction costs and so on, and really, I think because our discussion is relatively high level, I think this is something that may be worth thinking about in terms of finalising the conceptual framework. We've actually ended up agreeing to undertake a separate project on public sector measurement, and that will start to look at some of these more detailed issues, what the actual bases of valuation and mean in practice, and some links with what the valuers mean and what the government finance statistics actually mean by those bases. On liabilities, I think we had exactly the same issues in terms of legally binding, non-legally binding, and so on. And we are really starting to get into testing what we had in the conceptual framework in a consultation paper that we've now put out on the very tricky subject of social benefits. So that's out there at the moment, and John will talk a bit about that in the IFAS session later on this afternoon. But I think certainly all the things that have been talked about we've wrestled with. I don't know whether that's reassuring or not, but anyway.
Any other? Now, one point I find very interesting that was summarized by Andrea in the 37 discussion. You know, someone suggested to take into consideration from the claimer's point of view. You know, I want to know more. The reason why I feel interesting is because, as I remember, most of the discussions is from the entity's point of view, obligor's point of view. And sometimes when the board debated any particular standards, look at from which angle will create difference. For example, when we discuss about the revenue standards, whether you look at transfer or control from sellers' point of view or from buyers' point of view, it sometimes is not so clear. And recently, in the revenue TIG about principal and agent, we changed the wording from positive sense to negative sense. And I think the purpose is to make the principles much clearer. But board members may not agree with each other. So I want to know more about your views, you know, about this, you know, from the claimer's point of view to see liability issues. I think it's very interesting, you know, whether from different angle would come out the same or better or clearer principle, you know, I think it's very interesting. Any other response from the chairs? No. Okay, we all control the time very well. And so now we have half an hour break, and we will come back 11:30 for the final session on disclosure initiative. Thank you very much. Thanks all the speakers.